Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, podcasting to you, as usual, from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. Today is the 6th of March 2014, and I'm very pleased to be speaking to Dr. Paul Cullen, who is a professor of medicine at the University of Munster in Germany, and a fellow of the Royal College of Physicians in Ireland. He's also managing director of a private medical laboratory in Munster and head of the organization Ärzte für das Leben, Doctors for Life in Germany, which organization I want to ask him about in due course. So, Dr. Cullen, thank you very much indeed for joining us on The Mind Renewed.
Yeah, thank you very much, Julian, for having me. Thank you.
It's a great pleasure. Now, I actually came to know of you, strangely enough, through your listening to this very podcast, because you got in touch with me towards the end of last year, and the things that you were saying in your emails to me so intrigued me that I thought it would be great to invite you onto the program. And over the weeks that we've been communicating, we've decided on a whole list of things to talk about, which, of course, we'll get into in a minute. But I'd like to start by asking you about the main thing that did intrigue me when you first contacted me, and that is that you said that a number of years ago you had had an experience of what many people call going down the rabbit hole, which of course is a way of saying something of a worldview change, and that that experience led you to make various different decisions in your life. So could I start by asking you to tell us a little bit more about yourself, your background, your work, including the Doctors for Life, and perhaps what it was that triggered this experience of coming to see things slightly differently?
Yeah, well, my background, firstly, I was born in Dublin, and I grew up there and studied medicine in Dublin, and qualified a long time ago now, 1983, and worked then in Dublin for a year initially, and moved then to Germany, then back to Ireland. Then I was in London for a few years at the Hammersmith Hospital. And then I ended up where I am now in Munster. And my particular field was internal medicine and then laboratory medicine, with a research interest in molecular biology and heart disease. Then when I got a bit more senior, I was the head of a group working on genetics at the German Society of Clinical Chemistry. And gradually, as I was working there, it became clear to me that there was really very little consideration among scientists of the implications of what we were doing among scientists and doctors. And this was started off with a certain amount of unease, which got more greater and greater as time went on. So that after a period of years, I came to the conclusion that I couldn't really do this anymore. I also could see that there was a movement towards, well, I suppose we'd have to call it almost a neo-eugenic movement appearing in medicine. And this then prompted me to change my focus, and I stopped working for the society, and then began with this organization in Germany, which is a small group. There are 150 members, doctors from all specialties, a lot, of course, of gynecologists, and we're the only medical organization in the German-speaking world which is focused entirely on right-to-life issues, particularly at the beginning of life and at the end of life. So those are issues related to abortion, to prenatal diagnosis on the one hand, and then to euthanasia on the other hand, yeah.
And could you explain at all how this neo-eugenics, you call it, was actually manifesting itself in the work that you were experiencing?
Well, I think that you know, neo-eugenics is, of course, a very hard term, but there is a definite push. Just an example, I think it's better just to talk about specific examples. Yeah. One of the tests at the moment is the population of women having children is getting older. When a woman is older, there's a higher risk of Down syndrome. And most women in Germany who are above a certain age, I think it's 35 or 30, it might even be, have a thing called first trimester screening, where there's a screening done for certain blood tests that indicate a higher risk of Down syndrome. If this test is positive, then there's a fetal chorion villus biopsy can be done, or amniocentesis, and that then can confirm the diagnosis. And if the diagnosis is confirmed that the child is very likely to have Down syndrome, well, then most of women who have that opt for an abortion. the result is that about 97% of children with Down syndrome are in fact aborted. Only about 3% are actually carried to term. Now, about 4 years ago, a method was developed to measure fetal DNA out of maternal blood. It turns out that after about 6 weeks of pregnancy, the DNA from the baby, a small amount of it appears, can pass through the placenta and appears in the blood of the mother. Now, this is a very small amount and it's difficult to measure, but there are methods now that can actually analyze this very effectively. And a number of companies, I think there are four different tests which are available now, and they can analyze at a very accurate level the DNA of the child from the blood of the mother. So it means it's a completely non-invasive test and it is virtually 100% certain. So the test is right almost all the time, which is in fact quite unusual. It's a very good test from a technical point of view. So when this came out, there was a big debate in Germany, where I live, and there was a big debate in Parliament about whether this kind of testing should be allowed. One of the things that was said, well, 97% of children with Down syndrome are aborted already. And one of the comments was, how are the other 3% getting away? In fact, they're not going to get away now because this test has 100% certainty. And the next generation of tests are already available or will be available very soon. So the first one was just Down syndrome. The second generation is not just chromosome 21, which is Down syndrome, but also chromosome 13, chromosome 18, the sex chromosome, of course. And now the next step will be for single gene disorders. So cystic fibrosis, for example, muscular dystrophy. So there will be selection for those. And then there will be selection at some stage for cancer predisposition genes. This already occurs in the United Kingdom. And of course, at some stage down the road, we have to think that there will be selection for other traits that we don't understand genetically at the moment, but that may become susceptible to genetic analysis. Things like short-sightedness, for example, mild hearing impairment, things like that. So we're getting into a kind of a selection society where we start off with one thing and one goes to the next. And the question then becomes, well, who decides then? If we're going to accept that this is possible, well, who's going to set the level? Who's going to decide what is an acceptable degree of quality of a human being? Who's going to make that decision? Mm. And
well, I have to say, really a kind of dystopian vision of complete control over who's born and who's not born. I mean, was it that the thing that really made you go down this rabbit hole that you talk about?
Well, this is it. And that when I started thinking about this in this particular way and seeing it in this particular way, when you then you just look at the normal, read the newspaper, read the normal medical press and, you know, just consume media like everybody else does, because your perspective has changed, suddenly you begin to see things differently than you did before. And I have to say, one of the feelings I had when this happened was a feeling of being duped. Mm. I did get the impression that I had let myself and a certain amount of annoyance with myself, that I felt that I had allowed myself to be duped for a number of years.
Yes, that's certainly a very common thing, is that where people say that they feel they've been lied to. And yeah. So, and certainly this is, as you know, you've heard many of the podcasts, I've expressed that many times, and I pinpoint particular things and I think, good heavens, I now feel that I'm lied to about this and I'm lied to about that. And it, as you say, it comes from, you know, this perception that things are not as you thought they were.
That's it. And I think, you know, as a doctor, I think that when you think about these right to life issues, one of the big the discussions going on at the moment is physician assisted suicide. A law was just passed in Belgium last week to allow euthanasia for children. So we have a position where a person below the age of 15, you know, is not allowed to see certain films, but they're allowed to decide. This seems to me to be a very sort of sinister move. So the question is, the physician is supposed to be the person who's doing this. But the physician, his primary duty is to his patient and to the life's patient. The person the patient can't be thinking when the doctor arrives, what's this guy thinking now about me? You know, what is what is he going to help me, or has he, you know, it's very, and I think it puts doctors in a very invidious position.
Yes. And it's often said in response to that sort of thing, well, you know, you can say, oh, well, it's the thin end of the wedge with it, and that's ridiculed very often. But I think there's something to be said for that, isn't there? I mean, there's that very famous quote by Sister Ruth Hiller during the Nazi period, where she and her convent sisters were looking after a lot of disabled children. And, you know, it was said to her, when did the moral state of the nation go? And she said something like, you know, when the first child was done away with, something like that, it started there. And then that was the very thin end. And the wedge does exist, and it happened thereafter, and we know that.
That's it. Well, this is it. You see, we've been down this route before, and particularly in Germany. And I think in Germany, I think there's probably a higher degree of sensitivity to these issues in Germany than there is in other countries. You know, I think that's true because of the history. But particularly in Germany, there was selection, you know, widespread sterilization. They had a program called T3, which was from Tiergartenstraße number 3, which was the address in Berlin where this was coordinated from. And it was a program throughout Germany to essentially gas disabled children. And the interesting thing was, it wasn't just the doctors who were doing this, the doctors were involved in this, but also in many cases, the parents were complicit in it. It was a terrible thing. And in fact, in Munster, the Bishop of Munster was a man called Cardinal von Galen, and he gave a famous sermon where he stood up against this. And the Nazis then, they were afraid to challenge him because it was a difficult period during the war. So they folded this action, they stopped it. But we've been down this route before.
Yes, but you see, many people would say we're in a more enlightened age. That wouldn't happen. You know, we have the experience of what happened before, so we can learn from it. It won't happen again.
Well, I mean, I've done this experiment myself. If you take texts from that era, okay, you can take a text and you can take a text from today. And if you black out the references, you know, to dates and so on, that will allow you to date a certain text. There may be some stylistic differences, but essentially it's the same text.
The same thoughts are there.
Same thoughts are there, yes. So if you compare it, the same arguments are being made. The arguments that are being made today are no different than the arguments that were made in the 20s and 30s. There's absolutely no difference.
And in many cases, the same kind of quackery is behind it as well.
Well, this is it. And I mean, the eugenics movement, of course, the Nazis implemented it, but it wasn't. The eugenics movement was very strong in the United States. It was strong in Britain. It wasn't just confined to the Nazis or to Germany by any means.
No.
And, you know, it's the roots of the eugenic movement were, in fact, in the 19th century. It wasn't, you know, and it was only the Nazis felt that they had the strength and the rigor to carry it out. But they weren't the only ones who had these ideas.
No, indeed. No, in fact, William Engdahl in his book, and we were talking to him last time, was in the book, says that the Nazis were very much, in many cases, looking towards the US and admiring because of the attitudes that were in there.
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so we've got to talk about a couple of main themes here, and these are, we've already touched on it, of course, but I mean, the first one roughly is the anti-human agenda in the corridors of power. Mm-hmm. And the second one, which we'll get on to in a few minutes, will be the abuse of science, which of course is related to that. So if we turn to this first thing that we're going to talk about here, you mentioned to me something called the Estrella Report, which I'd not heard of before. Mm-hmm. And this was a report that was named after the Portuguese MEP Edita Estrella, and it was put before the European Parliament last year. Thankfully, it was rejected at the time. But it was a calling for, well, among other things, it was calling for abortion on demand with no restrictions to be declared a human right, and also for sex education to be given to children as young as, well, babies, toddlers, and all this under the banner of sexual reproductive health. And as you said to me in your email, this caused fiery exchanges in the European Parliament, but it wasn't even reported in the mainstream media. And I was completely unaware of it until you pointed it out. So could you tell us a bit more about this Estrella report and what was in it?
Well, the Estrella report, there was a Portuguese member of the European Parliament called Edita Estrella. Now, it turned out that the report that she brought in had, in fact, not been written by her. It had been written by lobby groups, in particular by Planned Parenthood. And the term sexual and reproductive health is code. Essentially, it stands for the things that you just said, Julian, and in particular, it stands for abortion on demand. And The idea is to force countries to introduce a liberal abortion legislation. Now, there are certain countries that, for example, Malta or Ireland, that have less liberal abortion legislation than other countries. And the idea is to get abortion to be declared a human right. And on the back of that, then, to force national governments to introduce it, to implement it in national law.
This is irrespective of what anybody might think, actually, in those countries.
Well, this is the whole point. The European law supersedes national law. So that if something like this is implemented at the European level, it is possible to have it sort of pushed down. It's a top-down approach. So it can then be implemented at the national level without essentially the citizens of those particular countries having a right to debate it. Particularly, this is happens with social legislation. Now, there were three elements to the Estrella report. The first one was related to abortion. The second, as you mentioned, was a mandatory and aggressive sex education for children, even children in primary school, and essentially disempowering parents to decide on these issues for themselves. And the third thing was to remove the freedom of conscience for doctors to refuse to participate in abortion if they don't agree with it. Now, one of the central planks of medical practice is that the doctor has freedom of conscience, that he does not have to participate in things that he feels are morally or ethically wrong.
Yeah.
And the Estrella report, one part of it was to remove the idea. The argumentation was that if women are living in a very remote area, this happens in Italy to an extent because a lot of doctors in Italy don't agree with abortion. So it can be, you know, a lot of hospitals don't provide it. And the idea was that if a woman is in a remote area and she goes to her local practitioner, he may not do it. So, because this then is discriminating against the woman, the doctor should be forced to carry out an abortion, whether he agrees with it or not.
So was that a case that is arguing for this to be right across the board? Or is that just where they would say, in certain cases where the woman couldn't find any other doctor, in that particular case, there would be a forcing of the issue?
Well, I mean, if this is a fundamental issue, Julian, so if you force it in one thing, once you've established the principle, you know, it's then just a question of implementation. I mean, once the principle has been established that doctors have no right of conscience, it becomes very difficult then to draw a line. What essentially happens in that circumstance is that, I mean, what happens at the moment is that doctors who hold these views, who are maybe against abortion, may find it difficult to hold a job. They may find it difficult to get employment in certain places. That happens already. But this would mean it would be legally impossible for them to refuse at a fundamental level.
This seems to take away the professionalism of the doctor as well, doesn't it? It's as if the doctor's just becoming a tool of the state.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. And I mean, there was a previous effort to do that in the European Council, the so-called McCafferty report, about a year or a year and a half previous to the Estrella report, maybe 2 years ago. And the European Council is a sort of it's a European talking shop. Many people haven't heard of it, but motions that are proposed at the European Council level have a habit of turning up later in European legislation and then subsequently turning up in national legislation. And the McCafferty report was aimed specifically towards reducing the ability of doctors to refuse to participate in abortion or other procedures on the basis of conscience. And this was spotted, in fact, by an Irish senator, a member of the Irish Senate, and an Italian parliamentarian who blocked it and managed to get a majority of members of the European Council to block it. So it never saw the light of day. But an interesting part of both of those, both the Estrella report and the McCafferty report, is that they got absolutely no mention in the mainstream media. And they were very important. The Estrella report was, when it was debated in the European Parliament, there was a tumult. You know, there are videos of it on YouTube. There was an actual, you know, almost a fight. And this got no reporting whatsoever. However, if it had been successful, if the report had been implemented, this would have been reported widely. So what we have here, and I mean, this is an area that I know about because it's an area that I'm involved in and interested in. I'm sure it's happening in other fields as well that I don't know about or that other people don't know about. So what is happening is that at a remote level, this sort of legislation is being prepared and is being fed subcutaneously, almost, if you like, into the system. And if a motion is blocked or if it doesn't get any further, there's no reporting. And if it's accepted, of course, then it's widely reported. So we have here a kind of a censorship in the sense that there's a very selective reporting of what is actually happening.
Yes, absolutely. As I say, I'd not heard of either the Estrella Report or indeed the Council of Europe. And I think it would be just worth spelling out some of the things which were asked for or demanded in the Estrella Report. I mean, you mentioned there was also this business of teaching sexuality education to children of a very, very young age. And this was apparently in accordance with the WHO standards for sexuality. Well, I looked that up and it actually recommends here, I'll just read exactly what it says. This is for ages 0 to 4 years to give information about enjoyment and pleasure when touching one's body, early childhood masturbation, and to give information about the right to explore gender identities. I mean, this seems to be incredible that this kind of thing is actually being, you know, it doesn't just say to answer children's questions here. It is actually give information about these issues. This seems incredibly intrusive and the sort of thing that certainly I as a parent wouldn't be very happy for some social worker or teacher or whatever to be actively informing my very, very young child about such matters. I mean, I'm personally quite happy if my child asks me questions and I, you know, respond in a suitable way. I don't wish to hide things, but to have this sort of active informing, as is what it says, I find that very difficult to accept. And this is the sort of thing that was being pushed through.
Well, this is it. I mean, the point is, it has to do with the fundamental question about who is fundamentally responsible for the education of the child. Is it the state or is it the parents? Who has the right to decide, you know, what the child should learn and what the child should not learn? And in fact, from a perspective of child psychology, there's actually quite a lot of information about this. And young children have a sexuality, but it's a different sexuality to that of adults. And, you know, to forcibly present a young child with this kind of information, which they can't understand, which they can't deal with, which is disturbing to them, is a kind of violation. Apart from anything else. And, you know, children, as you said yourself, they tend to ask this themselves. And there is, of course, a certain level at which sex education has to be carried out, but certainly not at the age of 4.
No, and there's a natural way of it occurring, isn't there? And it's in the report itself. It does actually say that, but it qualifies it by saying, well, I will read that. It says the subconscious or natural way of teaching and learning about sexuality can be complemented by an active way of teaching and informing. The benefit of this approach is the normalization of the topic of sexuality. So it's it actually saying there is a normal teaching, learning thing that happens, but it's forcing this proactive way, which I think is, I personally think is inappropriate.
Well, it is. And I think as the other thing is, it's not as if we have a society where there's too little sexualization.
No.
The entire imagery in our society runs on sexualization. And if anything, we have a problem with over-sexualization of society. And there's a kind of a, you know, the more sex there is outside in the street, the less is going on in the bedroom. I mean, there's a kind of a sexualization and desexualization going on at the same time, which is a curious phenomenon. But I mean, I don't want to get into that to any large extent, but
no.
Happening, yeah.
No, and as you say, the bigger issue is this whole question of the state stepping in and taking over things which really should be the role of the family to deal with, really.
Yeah, that's what it is. And it has, of course, the whole thing about the idea of controlling reproduction. I mean, that's the second big issue. It has to do with something that you've touched in your podcast many times, which is the population agenda. And I was alerted to this many years ago when I found a book in French by a man called, his name was Hervé Lebras, Limits to Population. And he's a head of, he's a demographer, quite a respected scientist. And he was talking about, you know, this kind of Malthusian idea that the resources are going to run out and so on, and that there's a population, that the population is much too large. There's absolutely no evidence for that. I mean, the population, the life expectancy worldwide at the moment is about 65 years, 66 years. OK, now to put that in perspective, life expectancy in Britain only reached 65 years. I think it would have been in the 50s, maybe in the 60s even. So despite all of this, you know, the things that we're hearing, how bad things are, and in certain areas they are bad, overall life expectancy worldwide is 65, which is actually quite, you know, not bad. And secondly, the second thing is that the price of most staples is not rising, but stable or coming down. So this is of course a tribute to the ingenuity of man, but it certainly, there is no evidence that in terms of overpopulation, that resources are running out, or that there's mass starvation. In fact, you know, up to about the 50s, it was the case that if starvation happened in a part of the world, sometimes there was no real solution to it, because we didn't have either, there wasn't enough food, or there weren't the logistics to get the food to where it was needed. That's no longer the case. You know, there's more than enough food in the world. We have more than enough means to get it to where it's needed. So if people are starving now, it's not because there's an absolute lack of food. It's because there are political problems, there are other problems, but there is no evidence that you know, the food is running out or anything like that.
And indeed, as Tim Ball was saying, there is actually a demographic problem in the Western countries in many cases where they're in future not going to be enough people around to keep things going.
Women in Germany have about 1.4 children per woman. Now, to maintain the population at the same level, you need 2.1. So this means that each generation of just Germans, as an example, is 30% smaller than the previous one. In fact, all over the Western world, this is the case. And the population of the world at the moment, I think, is about 7 billion. But the rate of growth of population is leveling off, and most of the projections say that it will probably level off at about 9 billion. This is, you know, the carrying capacity. I'm not an expert on this, but there is no evidence that exceeds the carrying capacity of the earth. And the problem, in fact, in the developed world and also in China with the one child policy, is that there's going to be a huge demographic problem. The average age, I think, of the German population now is about 45. So, you know, the problem that many countries have is not overpopulation, but as you say, a lack of children. That's the major problem in many countries. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to come back to this question of population reduction actually in a moment in connection with the term reproductive health. I wanted to ask you something about the Council of Europe, because you talked about that and said that I had not heard of it before. Could you tell us a little bit more about that? I mean, is this a democratic entity?
Well, I think I'm not an expert on the Council of Europe, but I think that most of the people who the members of the Council of Europe are politicians that are nominated by their home countries or by political parties. It's not a legislative assembly. If you look at the website of the Council of Europe, I'll just read it here. The role that the Council of Europe plays in promoting, protecting human rights, democracy and the rule of law in Europe, and its position as a champion of democracy in the internal arena. So it is no legislative powers, but it's essentially made up by politicians.
Yeah, so it's a champion of democracy, but it itself is an elitist organization, essentially.
Yes, it is. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And its deliberations are usually not reported on. But the reports that are produced in the Council of Europe have then a certain acceptability, and they then become the basis often for legislation, often at a European level. It's an area where pressure groups, elitist groups, can cook up an idea and get it formulated, get a kind of acceptance for it. Of course, there's a vote taken in the Council of Europe, but often these things are not noticed. And then once it's passed by the Council of Europe, it can then turn up later in European law. And then suddenly, you know, it appears in for example, national law. And that's how a lot of these measures, particularly in relation to social issues, are handled.
So we have a situation where potential legislation is being developed by this Council of Europe quite undemocratically and quite in a hidden way, and it can just gradually slip quietly through the processes into legislation, and it really is up to people to notice that there's something a little bit odd going on. So this is intrinsically undemocratic in every way.
Well, this is it, yes, and it's sort of pseudo-democracy.
So I want to ask you about this question of reproductive health, or sexual and reproductive health. It seems to be a term that's used a lot. Tim Ball in one podcast was complaining about the use of these kinds of bureaucratic terms, as you know, a term is only really as good as the definition you give it, and it can therefore be used for pretty much anything you like. And of course, it sounds great, doesn't it? Sexual reproductive health, and everybody obviously wants people to be healthy, but I get the impression from what you say that you're very, very suspicious of this term, and you believe that it is somewhat of a cover for population control agenda.
Well, this is it. I mean, one of the main areas where this term is used is the United Nations. If you look at the website of the United Nations and you put in the term reproductive health, it says that reproductive health is a program that aims to provide a basis for having healthy children, intimate relationships, and happy families. Now, who could be against that?
Absolutely, yes. So therefore, one has to go along with everything they do.
That's it. So, you know, this is the way it's presented. But when you actually drill down and find out what it actually means, what it turns out is it's a code for abortion on demand and other means, not just abortion on demand, other means of population control, for example, long-acting contraceptives. Particularly in Africa, in a lot of African countries, there's resistance to this. This now, the implementation of these reproductive health programs is in certain cases being made a prerequisite of getting aid, for example. That's the first area. So at the government level, these countries are being strong-armed, if you like, into implementing this because it's being made a basis for getting aid. And on the other hand, there are a lot of organizations, for example, the Gates Foundation is involved in this. Warren Buffett's organization is involved in this at one remove. So a lot of these private so-called philanthropic organizations are pushing this agenda as well. There's no doubt about that.
And this very much fits again with what William Engdahl was saying last time about the Kissinger report, because that did seem to set the stage for this kind of, if you're making moves on population stabilization reduction, then you can perhaps be in receipt of aid. That was very much coming in there, wasn't it, in the middle of the 1970s. Do you feel that that policy then has actually found its way fairly and squarely into what the UN is doing?
Well, I'm not an expert on the UN, but certainly from what I know, I think it has. But I think it is also, you know, there's a sort of a radical eco movement. There was a book which was published about 3 years ago called The World Without Us. And the book was a kind of a thought experiment. If all the humans were to die out, what would happen to the world? How long would it take for nature to sort of reassert itself? And that sounded interesting. But when you got down to it, it turned out that there are a number of, they are radical organizations, but at the same time, there is a sort of a fringe of the ecology movement that is of the opinion that the world would be better off if there were no people at all.
Including themselves, presumably.
Including themselves, yes. Yeah. So there's a movement, in fact, which I was amazed to find out. There's a movement that advocates a complete stop of children, having no children. It's kind of the last generation. So there are going to be no more children, and that's it. The world would be better than if there were no people at all.
But wouldn't you say that's just some sort of a wacky group, but this doesn't represent anybody who's in any position to make any difference to anything?
Well, I think, you know, that in every movement, there's a kind of a bell curve, isn't there? The majority of people are going to be in the middle. And then there are going to be some people that are maybe only slightly interested in the topic. And then there are going to be some people at the other extreme who have quite radical views. But what is happening is if this radical wing, they may be small, but they can actually push the center slightly in one direction. So that, you know, you might say, OK, well, of course, we don't want there to be no people. There should be maybe 2 billion or maybe a billion or maybe 500 million. But certainly not 7, and certainly it shouldn't get any more than it is now. So it is an extreme end of a spectrum, but it is evidence of a mindset that exists. I'm not making this up. I mean, I was completely gobsmacked actually to find it, and I went into it and I researched to see was it true, and it is true. There are these organizations, yeah.
And what I'm about to say here, I'm also not making up. And the reason why I mentioned the UN was because I found that the World Health Organization, I did ask you earlier whether you would want to comment upon this, so I'm inviting you to comment upon this. This was back in the 1990s, the early 1990s, the WHO, with Rockefeller Foundation support, among other things, was apparently carrying out a very dubious mass vaccination program. And there was a guy called James Miller, who was writing for Human Life International Reports in the mid-90s, and he said that there was a Catholic lay organization in Mexico that had got some chemists to analyze the WHO tetanus vaccine that they were using, and they found that it had human chorionic gonadotrophin in it, and that apparently that's naturally occurring. A woman has to have that and have to have a normal pregnancy, but if you introduce that with a tetanus vaccine, then the body produces antibodies to that, the chorionic gonadotrophin, and therefore the chances are you're not going to have a successful pregnancy. And apparently this was being given to women in Mexico, Philippines, Nicaragua, and it was only women that were vaccinated between the ages of 15 and 45, or in Nicaragua between the ages of 12 and 49. It was found that this particular hormone was there in the vaccines. It shouldn't have been there. They were being given many more injections than was necessary. You only need to give it every 10 years for tetanus, but apparently they'll be given three within 3 months and a total of five altogether. You know, it had also been the case that the WHO knew that this could well be the result of this particular mixture, because there was research published in the Lancet a couple of years before that that showed that they knew exactly what this was. So, you know, do you have any comment upon that?
Well, I'm not aware of that particular program. I hadn't heard of it before, but I mean, if you are going to be injecting HCG, if you're injecting that, you will get antibodies towards it, and that will then prevent it from acting, and it would have the effect that you say. But I have to say, I hadn't heard of it previously, I wouldn't really like to comment on that, Julian, because
Okay. So I'd like to move to the second area that we said that we would talk about, which of course is the abuse of science, which is very much potentially involved with the kinds of things that we've already been talking about. Mm-hmm. So as we know, science can be abused for various reasons, political reasons, commercial reasons, and we get the impression that there's more and more of this in the modern world. And I don't know whether that's just because we're more exposed to it through the TV. You know, you didn't have that in the past. And of course, the one that comes to mind especially is climate science. Certainly over the years that I've been looking into this kind of thing, I've got the impression that it is very much being abused for various reasons. And the guests that I've had on the program have all said in various ways that this kind of science is being manipulated for very often ideological reasons. But in the case of Dr. Niels Axel Mohner, who came on as the sea level expert, he was saying that the manipulation has got to such a stage that actually the evidence on the ground in some cases is being tampered with. And he had the famous example of the tree, which he found that showed a certain evidence about sea level. And that when he went back the next time, it had been removed, apparently, by a group of Australian scientists, so he was told. And he was saying, well, this is evidence that, you know, if something's not convenient, it will actually be removed these days. So I want to ask you what your take is on all this. Do you think this kind of thing has been always this bad, or do you think this abuse is becoming more extreme and widespread in the modern world?
To answer your first question, I don't think it's always been that bad. The second question, I think what we're seeing is there are certain examples of blatant abuse, such as that you cited. But I think that's probably more the exception. I think what's happening, though, is a more insidious change in science. If you look at the history of science, as we know it, if we start with the Enlightenment, for example, initially, scientists, the original scientists as we know them, they would have been people who would have been had a rich sponsor, perhaps the king or a nobleman who would have kept the scientists in the same way that he had maybe a musician and a peacock in his garden. And the scientist then was allowed to do more or less whatever he wanted once he then, when he was writing his manuscript, praised his sponsor lavishly enough.
And, yes. By the way, be careful, because I'm a musician, so don't liken me to a peacock.
No, but they were the people who were doing that, they were more or less free to do what they wanted. And then in the 19th century, a lot of the scientists then were people of independent means. On the one hand, they were either people of independent means who were working just for the interest of it, or they were people on the more practical side who were looking for industrial applications. They were looking for things that worked. So both of these were interested in truth. On the one hand, because that was they had no alternative agenda, and secondly, because it had to be true, because they wanted to make money out of it ultimately. Now, what happened was I think really what happened with this, with after the First World War in particular, you had an industrialization of warfare, and you also had an industrialization of science. And the industrialization that we saw, the governments, I think it probably happened around the First World War, realized that scientific knowledge is an essential part, in particular in military applications and in military domination. So there was a push from that point of view for governments to dominate science. And also it was recognized as an important economic goal. So if you look at how science is done now, and almost all of science that's done now is funded either by governments or by big corporations. There are very few individuals or free spirits, if you like, doing science. Now, there are a lot of people doing science. Some of them are maybe a bit nutty. But most of the science, if you look at, is being funded by these two groups. So the way this works in practice is if you have a scientific idea or if you're working in a program, you have to get grant money. Usually. Now, if you're getting grant money, you have to write a grant application. Now, the grant application is going to be surveyed by your peers who are other scientists. So this automatically leads to a kind of uniformity. And it automatically leads to a situation where unusual ideas or maybe really inventive ideas are not going to be accepted. So this leads to a reduction in creativity. And also, of course, when you mentioned climate science. Now, one of the hallmarks of the debate in climate science, I'm not an expert on climate science, but I know that one of the hallmarks of the debate is that they say, there's unanimity among scientists, there's consensus. But consensus is to a large extent the exact antithesis of science. It's the exact opposite of science. And I mean, if for a thing to be an invention, to be new, or to be a discovery means it has to go against the consensus, otherwise it wouldn't be a discovery. So I mean, the classic example, of course, is Copernicus or Galileo, but there are other inventions. So, for example, when Einstein came up with the theory of relativity, this was completely counterintuitive. It didn't actually invalidate Newtonian physics, but it said that Newtonian physics is only valid within this particular frame of reference, and outside that, then relativistic mechanisms take over. So what's happening now is, though, you have this kind of a lockstep approach to science where it's very difficult for somebody who thinks outside the box or has unusual ideas to get funding. And if he gets funding and gets the results, it's going to be equally difficult for him to get published.
But that goes right against what most people would think of as the scientific processes. They would think, presumably, of somebody coming up with a nice new idea and bring it to their peers, and they'd all sit around and discuss it. And if it's really interesting, then somebody would say, "Well, yes, I think that should be pursued. Let's see if we can get a research grant for that." But you're saying that in many cases it doesn't work that way.
No, it doesn't, and it's not that the scientists, that the people reviewing the grants are bad people. I mean, sometimes they are, but that's not always the case. It's just that they have a particular view of the field. Those are the people who are dominating the field, otherwise they wouldn't be in a position to be reviewing grants. And the other thing I wanted to say, Julian, is that whereas previously there would have been very few scientists, now there are armies of scientists. There are about, I think, 400,000 papers published every year in medicine alone, or certainly more than 200,000. I think somewhere between 200,000 and 400,000 papers are published every year. And, there's the maximum publish or perish. If you don't publish, you're not going to survive. So there's a huge amount of stuff being put out by a huge army of individuals. And each of these then is working on a tiny little question. So what happens as well then, if you get into a field, there's a lot of subspecialization. So what you find then is that in your particular field, there will maybe be 10 people. And these 10 people, they are the ones that then are reviewing the grants. They are the ones that are maybe reviewing the publications. Now, I'm not criticizing the entire method, but you can see the danger in such an approach, that it can be very difficult then for somebody to really go against accepted thought.
So they're existing in this very, very sort of parochial atmosphere with looking at a particularly a very small area of a larger science. And it may be the case that these 10 people, you say, may never actually question the larger paradigm in which they're working. And so the whole thing is sort of self-reinforcing all the time.
Well, this is it. And then if you add the next two layers to that, the next layer, of course, is that there's a big push at the moment. There's an entire economization of life. So the only metric by which we are to value or to measure the value of a thing is how much it's worth in money terms. So when a government is, for example, looking at a research project, it will look at its value in economic terms only. So a scientific idea, even if it's maybe interesting scientifically, if it's not going to produce some kind of economic benefit in the medium or short term, is not going to get anywhere. And then the second level is that the political level, where there are particular things, I would imagine, in the field of climate science, but also in other fields, particularly in social biology, in social fields, and to a certain extent in biology, where there is a particular zeitgeist or a particular political view, which then impacts on the work that's coming out. So you have a number of layers that make it very difficult then for science to behave as it's supposed to behave.
Yes, and as it's supposed to behave, I mean, I know that you've said to me that you agree with Karl Popper with his falsification principle, but do you feel that everything that you've said there, in a way, sort of says that, well, Popper's view, although it's right, it nevertheless is a kind of ideal situation, and actually we're seeing more and more that the sort of Thomas Kuhn view that there is a paradigm that's extremely difficult to break out of is actually becoming more and more the case?
Well, I think what Thomas Kuhn said is true. I mean, he came up with the notion of a paradigm shift. And this was actually quite revolutionary, because up to then we had the idea that science proceeds in a long sloping upward curve of gradual improvement. But what actually happens is it proceeds and stops and starts. So there's a paradigm. The paradigm is, for example, the Earth is in the center and the sun goes around the Earth. And this in fact, was the Greeks, in fact, knew that it was the other way around. I only found that out recently. But this then, Copernicus then discovered that, no, it's the other way around. And then, you know, there was a big resistance to this idea. And then there was a sort of a seismic shift. And then we're in the next model. And this is how science proceeds. It proceeds by stops and starts. But what happens is that when one of these changes occurs, when a paradigm shift occurs, it's not that the people who cling to the old paradigm are converted. In fact, it's converted. Science proceeds by the death of the previous generation.
yes, indeed, that's a lovely quote, that one.
because this generation has to die out, and gradually the new scientists coming up then will adopt the new paradigm.
So, because of all these pressures that you've been talking about, do you feel then that it's becoming increasingly difficult for these large paradigms to shift, and that it's, you say, you know, things can change by, you know, the death of scientists, you can have a new generation arise, but is even that being challenged now? Because people, you know, scientists do die off, of course, but a new generation comes up and they're enculturated in the existing paradigm. And that is so strong. I mean, Tim Ball was saying to me that actually some of many of the true believers in the climate change orthodoxy are the young ones. Yeah. And it's the old guys who are challenging it.
That's correct. Well, I think that has to do with the fact that only older people whose careers are behind them can afford to do it.
Indeed. Indeed. Yeah, but does that not show that the paradigm is sort of even these days is becoming sort of really self-reinforcing?
Well, I think what has happened is that governments have begun to realize that science is one of those areas where, you know, it can be very difficult if you have a particular political agenda. Science is an area where people can develop arguments to resist an agenda. So if you capture the high scientific ground, it makes it easier to implement a political agenda and robs the opposite side of its argument. So what is actually happening to an extent is there's a poisoning of the source of knowledge to actually rob people of their ability to resist, because the tools that you need to resist are being stolen. Because if you like, the furnace in which the tools would normally be forged is being poisoned. Because the knowledge that you would need, or the information that you would need to argue against a particular trend, is being contaminated. Now, of course, there's always been political influence, and there's always been a political the science. Scientists are part of the society. They don't live in a vacuum. They're part of the time in which they live. So this idea that there's a pure sort of activity uncontaminated by social forces is probably wrong. But I do think that at the moment, in the present time, there is a degree of influence. I mean, there are these other elements that we spoke about the way science itself is structured. But I do think that there's a level of political control that is trying to force the agenda by only allowing particular views or only accepting particular views as valid. And I think that this has to do with energy. I think it has to do with issues like population. I think it has to do with things like social issues, for example, sexuality. And I think those are the areas where there's a particular degree of political control. Yeah.
And I also wanted to ask you, in connection with this, and we're becoming perhaps a little esoteric with this, but I do think this is an important one to bring up, and that you say how there is this control of the tools of science. I'm wondering if you feel that this notion of post-normal science is also something which is ripe for control. I have mentioned this once or two in another podcast, but not gone into it in any detail, because we know that there are some anthropogenic global warming advocates who acknowledge that this view of science, this post-normal science, is operative in the field of climate science. And this is a view that was developed by a guy called Jerome Rivets at Oxford University and others. And I'm not criticizing him. He is describing something that exists. And so the idea here then is that you have normal science, the sort of fact-based hypothesis testing, striving for objectivity that we normally think of as science. But here with this post-normal science, the idea is that it's dealing with fields of study where, I'll actually quote what Rivette says about this, fields of study where, quote, facts are uncertain, values in dispute, stakes high, and decisions urgent, end quote. So that you need a wider kind of societal dialogue. You can't just deal with the facts on the ground all the time. Now, what do you think of that kind of scientific enterprise? Do you think that is actually going away from real science? Do you feel that there's a possibility that the tools of science are being ripped up at that point?
Well, I think it's irrelevant to science. I mean, of the things that you mentioned, for example, one of them is high stakes, urgent decisions. This has absolutely nothing to do with science. I would, in fact, say if the stakes are high and if the decisions are urgent, well, then you need to be particularly careful. And the fourth idea of embedded values, which is one of the things they talk about, the values of the scientist should have no influence in his research. If you're looking at a particular physical phenomenon or chemical phenomenon, you should just confine yourself to the data and confine yourself to the experiment and try and think of a clever experiment and try and analyze the data in the best way you can. And then, see what the experiment is telling you or what the result is telling you.
Yes, but of course, what they would say is that that's a kind of science where that's fine. You can use the classical approach to that. But in something like, for example, climate science, they would say it's so uncertain that you can't hope to be as objective about it. And yet the stakes are so high because it may be that we're going to have runaway global warming and the world is going to end. And so you've got to have a wider discussion. You can't just leave it to the normal business of science because, we don't know enough about it. And if you get it wrong, we could all be dead.
Okay, but you can't. But then it's not a scientific discussion. Then it's outside. Then it has nothing to do with science. Then it's something else, but it's not science.
But they would say it is, that science is involved. They would say, well, there's a certain percentage of science in there that's tipping us off to the fact that there may be a problem.
Well, okay, but that's then one. It's like a mosaic. So that's one little stone in the mosaic is the scientific element. Then there are other elements in the mosaic which have nothing to do with science. Science is not a collection of knowledge. Science is an approach. Science is a way to look at the world. It's a way to ask questions. It's a way to decide on what is closer to the truth and what is essentially science is to decide what is not true. That's the purpose of science in the natural world. That's what it's for. And if the uncertainties are high, if you can't measure whatever the parameter is that you want to measure, well, then you can't measure it. That's it. You can't do the science if you come up with some way of measuring it. Well, that's maybe science. You can think about it. But anything else is not science. It's politics. It's something else. But it's not science.
So it's messing around with the terminology, and that in itself is a kind of invitation for it to be exploited by various political concerns.
Well, what they're trying to do is they're trying to put on this garment of science, to clothe themselves in the robe of science, to get the prestige, but without doing the work. You know, science has this idea that it has a certain amount of prestige. So people who have a different agenda want to clothe themselves in science, in the cloak of science, and they're presenting something because they think that this will strengthen their argument. But it's in fact a misuse of the term.
Well, I sent you that link to that very famous article by Mike Hume, Professor of Climate and Culture at the Department of Geography at King's College London. This is an article in The Guardian from 2007. And he admits that, he actually says science is being taken off center stage. I'll read the quote. He says, "The danger of a normal reading of science is that it assumes science can first find truth, then speak truth to power, and that truth-based policy will then follow." And then he goes on and he says, "In fact, in order to make progress about how we manage climate change, we have to take science off center stage," which I thought was quite an admission, really. And he's talking a lot about this post-Nobel science here.
Well, I mean, this is it, but it's not. You can call it what you like, but it's not science. It's important to differentiate between different kinds of truth. There's a scientific truth, which is one way of thinking about things, but there are also other kinds of truth that have to do with human existence in the way, for example, a poem is true or a feeling is true. These are true things as well, but it's a different. So what we're having, what we have here is as well a kind of a mixture of language as well as everything else, where terms are applied to a semantic field that they don't apply to. It's a kind of a sleight of hand, a linguistic sleight of hand, if you like.
Yeah. Do you think it also comes from that sort of scientistic attitude that's out there, that something can only be true knowledge if it's science, and so therefore if there is a field of knowledge that does actually give you truth, we must clothe it with the term science in order for it to be respectable?
That's it, that part of that as well. Yeah, it is. Of course, in the kind of neo-atheist movement, this is completely this kind of stuff,
and very shallow, I have to say.
Oh, terrible. I mean, you don't quote me on this one, but I mean that Dawkins, I used to read his books, and I used to, you know, when he came out first, I actually quite liked it, and he's just got more and more off the beam, and he completely ignores the spiritual dimension of man completely. This kind of reductionist view that you can reduce all of human existence down to this way of looking at things. Science is great, but it's only for a particular part of existence. There are other parts of existence that are not amenable to science. It doesn't make them less important. It's just different.
Yes, and he seems to fall into that sort of positivistic trap, doesn't he? Saying these are things that are only really knowledge if they're scientific. And then, of course, you realize, well, that statement itself is not a scientific statement, yet he's claiming it's knowledge. It's sort of self-defeating.
That's it. Yeah. That's it. And I mean, the things that make, of course, our lives worthwhile have nothing to do with science and cannot be discerned by scientific means. But I mean, I think in terms of post-normal science, that we're living in this post-modern age. And so post-modern age, of course, rejects the idea that there's any such thing as truth. So there's a deliberate misunderstanding of this idea of relative truth in science. It doesn't mean that there's no such thing as truth, but there's an idea that everything is just is relative. Everything is a social construct, and there's no validity to anything. This is part of that sort of broader notion as well. Yeah.
Indeed, where you have in certain forms of postmodern, you sort of have words floating around in a kind of never-never world where they only mean things in relation to each other, but they don't refer to anything outside of themselves and that kind of thinking. And do you really feel that that has actually started to crop up in science?
Well, I think it has. I think it has, yes. And I mean, one thing that just a small thing that amuses me that's anecdotal is that for about 15 years now, there's been a trend in medical papers not to refer to sex, but refer to gender. Now, this was before the big gender debate started. And it was because I think a lot of physicians thought that gender was a little bit more posh than sex, you see. But in fact, gender and sex refer to completely different things. Sex refers to the biological sex of the individual, whereas gender is a social construct. What, you know, there are many, you can have a gender is assigned, but sex is the way you are. So what you're having here is that we have a sort of fuzzy thinking that people aren't, the people who are writing these papers are not thinking about what they're actually saying. If a person, for example, a patient in a study is male or female, do they have an XX chromosome or an XY chromosome? That's what it means. And gender is a completely different category of completely. But what's happening is that there's a kind of contamination of science with this sort of, I don't know what it is, this sort of fuzzy thinking that's going around at the moment. Yeah.
And so do you feel with all these kinds of approaches that we've been talking about, you know, whether it would be the post-normal science or this sort of deconstructionist view of language here with gender and that sort of thing, that it's not just a sort of cultural phenomenon, although it is that, but that it's not just that, but also that this makes the language useful for various elites to control that fuzziness of thinking so that they can steer policy in various ways. Do you feel that that is actually what is going on with some of these moves?
Well, I think certainly there is a sort of an attempt to keep people, Julian, on the back foot so that people are reeling. There's a sort of information overload. And then there's the idea everybody should be working. Everybody should have a full-time job. The only thing that counts is economic terms. The only thing that counts is money, distraction the whole time. And then a kind of dilution of the language as well. So the poor unfortunate individual is the whole time reeling. He's on his back foot and it keeps him off guard. The idea, I think to a certain extent, the idea is to keep the individual off guard and to keep him distracted, to keep him occupied with other things. I don't want to overdo this, but I do think there is an element of that. And then, you know, once you have people who aren't paying attention, as it were, then you can work on your agenda, as we spoke about previously, and develop things that are then slowly, slowly, subcutaneously fed into the system. I think there is an element of that, yes.
So what would you say is the way in which we can actually start to break out of this situation? I mean, even if one thinks to oneself, well, some of this is being controlled in some ways, a lot of it, one might say, is just because of the way Western thought has developed, for example.
Yes.
But nevertheless, however this state of affairs may have come about, how can we actually break out of this, give the freedom to ourselves and to other people to think clearly and to realize that there is the potential for being manipulated because of this fuzziness of thinking all around us? How can we break out of that so that people can think clearly?
Well, I think it has to start with the individual. So I think the first thing is what we spoke about at the beginning of our interview, going down the rabbit hole, you know, that each individual has to have a sort of moment of awakening for themselves. And then, of course, this is uncomfortable then. So you have to live with the uncomfortableness. But each individual, it's almost like the film The Matrix, where the person comes out of the Matrix and then they discover that you're not on your own. There are other people, you know, who think like this. But it is a lot more arduous. And I think once you've made this transition yourself, you automatically find that you see things differently. I think as well that it's important that these reserves of inner strength that people have to be preserved. I think reserves of inner strength are the family, I think, is a reserve of inner strength. I think it's important to have a certain degree of continence with regard to consumption of media. I think important is things like faith. If you know, if you're a believing person, I think this is a reserve of inner strength. And also a degree of just common sense and just a certain almost pig-headedness.
I was going to ask you that. Should one sort of fundamentally trust one's intuitions? And I don't mean that by that, you know, any thought that comes into your mind, believe that it's true. But there are certain things that we instinctively believe to be true, you know, just to take a ridiculous example, which we all believe, you know, there is such a thing as an extension in space. We can, you know, I can see that tree over there. And I know I don't know what the measurement is, but there is a distance, you know, and there are other minds in the world. And there are these various intuitions. We know that they are the case and we need to hold on to those and not be persuaded by other people. Even those fundamental intuitions are fuzzy.
Well, they're certainly in terms of working hypotheses the best we have, and we certainly have to accept that. And I think we have to accept not just externalities, but also our own feelings, our own judgments on things, our own moral intuition. you know, we have to have more confidence in ourselves and not defer to experts. I think that's really important.
This can sound like sort of very highfalutin, but actually no, because there are very influential people who will tell us such things as we do not have free will. We are completely deterministic entities. So once you start thinking along those lines, you are denying your own intuition of your very selfhood. And I agree with you. We have to say, okay, we don't absolutely know. We can't prove various things such as my consciousness. I can't prove it. Nevertheless, there is a kind of basis for living in the world, which we have to start from somewhere. And if we deny that starting point, we've lost everything, haven't we?
Well, the thing is, I mean, even mathematics depends on axioms,
yes,
which we take to be true, which we can no longer prove. So all of knowledge is based on axioms, and all of particularly Western thought, you know, depends on we have a certain amount of axioms that we start from. And if we deny these axioms, it means, as you just said, it means there is no basis to anything. I mean, this is not just the case for human life. This is the case for mathematics. This is the case for all of science, that all of science is you can boil it down to a certain number of irreducible axioms that are no longer provable, that just have to be assumed. But I mean, at the same time, we know instinctively that these are true. They have a ring of truth to them. And we just have to accept that and go along with that. And I mean, but there's no reason to doubt them. The problem is that the people who are trying to manipulate us, they don't have these discussions internally. Maybe some of them do. What is happening is that there is an attempt to put over a particular mind view on us. And we don't have to go along with that.
No, absolutely. It starts with each individual holding on to certain, as you say, certain axioms, which we take to be true, and we lose ourselves if we lose those things. From there, then we can have a certain strength, an inner strength, to fight off some of these unfortunate influences that are coming our way every day, in fact, through various ways. So thank you ever so much. This has been a really, really fascinating conversation. In fact, we've touched on all sorts of subjects, and this is one of those interviews where I feel I just would love to go on and on talking forever about all sorts of side issues, but of course we do have to bring it to a close at some point. So we shall close in a moment, but I just wondered if there was a way in which you would like to collect the thoughts that we've had, the various themes that we've been exploring, into a sort of last message that you'd like to bring over. I know that's a very, very big thing to ask.
Well, I would say think for yourself, be optimistic, maintain a sense of humor.
And
don't give up. The human spirit is unconquerable. I think we're living in a time that's confused. So if everybody else is confused, you yourself have to be trying and think particularly clearly. That I think that's probably the main thing.
Well, thank you ever so much, Dr. Cullen. It really has been excellent speaking to you, and I'm so glad you contacted me in the first place and made me feel so free to ask you to come on. I'm very glad I asked you and you said yes. Thank you ever so much. It's been a brilliant conversation.
Thank you very much, Julian. I appreciate it. Thank you.